Good morning. This meeting of the House Community and Regional Affairs Committee will come to order. Today is Thursday, February 27th. The time is 8:02. Members present are Representative Klayman, Representative Thompson, Representative Christ Thompson, Representative Johnson, and myself, Representative Hannon. We have a quorum to conduct business. I'd like to remind everyone to please silence their cell phones. Today, our recording secretary is Lori Rowland, and Madison Truitt is our LIO moderator, assisting with teleconference support. Thank you to both. My staff, Tim Clark, is our committee aide. If you have notes to pass for others at the table, please get Tim's attention. Today's agenda includes House Bill 221, State Recognition of Tribes, sponsored by Representative Chuck Kopp. Following House Bill 221, we'll turn to Representative Story's House Bill 193, which proposes adding a second verse to the Alaska State Song. For both of these bills, we will only have invited testimony today. Public testimony will be taken when the bills are brought up again by the committee in the near future. And with that, we'll ask Representative Kopp and his staff to join us at the table. So come on up and put yourselves on the record.
Thank you, Madam Chair. For the record, my name is Chuck Kopp, House Representative for District 24. And I have with me my team member, Ken Truitt. Ken, do you want to?
Good morning, Madam Chair. Ken Truitt, staff for Representative Kopp, and I also provided to you my tribal introduction, which is I told you that I'm Tlingit and my names are Tuksaic and Kadishan. Good morning.
Good morning.
And so, Madam Chair, Ken has been a great helped me drafting this bill and working with a large group of entities around this state. He is an attorney in my office. Most of you know he was with the Attorney General's office for many years and was general counsel to CERC, the Southeast Alaska Regional Health Corporation, for a long time, which is the health consortium for this region, and was also chief operating officer of Tlingit and Haida, the regional tribal government in Southeast Alaska. Madam Chair, this bill simply does one thing, and it provides for state recognition of tribes that are already federally recognized. That's what the bill does in one sentence, but it means much more than that, and I'll explain that further, Madam Chair. Alaska's tribal people have a beautiful ancient past in this land. They've been here for many thousands of years. And this bill is about giving the honor and the respect and the self-determination that any people cry out for as a people. It is natural that we would recognize the tribal citizens that are all around us, which encompass fully 20% of our state population. This bill is about making sure that Alaska's indigenous people are no longer invisible in the narrative of our state history. We will discuss concepts like sovereignty, and on the questions of sovereignty, we can't on one hand pretend that tribes don't exist, but on the other hand insist that they waive their sovereign immunity before the state will partner with them in a program. There's only 8 countries in the world, Madam Chair, that have a landmass larger than Alaska. And we are one state that desperately needs to move into collaborative partnering with our tribes to overcome the significant challenges that we have in education, public safety, health care. This is a move in that direction towards collaborative partnership. Change is hard because it encompasses both emotional and spiritual dimension. It's hard work. It's also heart work. But it's time that we acknowledge that tribes are in the best position to deliver many of the services the state has not been able to successfully deliver over many decades, and that these are Alaskans that are closest to the people to deliver the services in their region. Before I get into the bill specifically, I would like to address several issues that may cause some to stumble, just address them head on. the issue of somehow granting special privileges to tribal people that non-tribal people do not get, and the issue of state sovereignty sometimes gets in the way of what are we doing here with tribal recognition. So the issue of specialness, some have a notion that the status of special rights or more, why would we give that to a tribal people or a non-tribal people? But I think that when viewed from the tribal perspective, that notion evokes questions like special, like having your land taken away without consent, special, like being told that you can no longer be in a certain place and relocated when there's been no declaration of war or hostilities against you. Why is this happening? You know, special, like the attacks that came on villages here in Southeast Alaska. So, you know, I look at special as just that the United States government is making good on its solemn promises to the indigenous people for the taking of land and removing them to new lands. And special also makes good on our promises of providing for the health, education, and welfare of the indigenous people in return for abandoning their claims to the land. One noted Indian scholar in 1940 said the country's indigenous people have undergone in the century and a half of their national existence changes in the habits, institutions, and needs and aspirations far greater than the changes that separate our own age from the age of Hammurabi and Justinian, Lycurgus, and Moses. So telescoped into just a century and a half of existence, Madam Chair, we find many social, political, and property relational changes which took Europe over 300 centuries to absorb. It's incredible that this type of rapid change was brought to a people so quickly in our country, and I would suggest that it is amazing that it has not destroyed them, but they are still strong as a people today. I think that Alaska's history and the scope of this change has been extreme for many of our indigenous people. And I believe it's right at the very heart of what President Nixon said in his special address on Indian Affairs in 1970. He said, "The story of the Indian in America is something more than the record of the white man's frequent aggression, broken agreements, intermittent remorse, and prolonged failure. It is a record also of endurance, of survival, of adaptation and creativity in the face of overwhelming obstacles. It is a record of enormous contributions to this country, to its art, its culture, to its strength and spirit, to its sense of history and sense of purpose." So I would submit, Madam Chair, that the special relationship enjoyed by the indigenous people is not something that any of the rest of us would trade places for. On the question of state sovereignty, we don't often really think back to and look at the colonial times and the period after the Revolutionary War and after the ratification, or I'm sorry, before the ratification of our Constitution. But it's instructive for how we got to where we're at today, because during the colonial period, the British Crown left management of Indian policies generally to the individual colonies, and most colonies tried extensively to regulate Indian trade and land concessions. Some expropriated land forcefully, which led to armed hostilities, and some negotiated diplomatically and worked out treaties. But inevitably, each colony had their own attempts and were always looking at any action, of course, that would favor the colony. But they all ended up with very different policies and approaches. So under the Articles of Confederation, the forebearer to our Constitution, there was an attempt to consolidate how the colonies would deal with Indian tribes to the federal government. This proved unsuccessful because we had a limited central government at that time with limited power over Indian affairs. And so contradictory policies continued to come forth, and separate management of Indian affairs by the colonies and early states proved uneven, inconsistent, and unsuccessful. And these failures led directly to Article 1, Section 8 of our U.S. Constitution. That says Congress shall have the power to regulate commerce with foreign nations and among the several states and with the Indian tribes. Very notably, that power was not left to the states. It was left to Congress. And regarding the Commerce Clause, Commerce had in 1878 a broader meaning referring to all forms of intercourse and affairs of life, whether or not narrowly economic or mediated by explicit markets. So structurally, the broader meaning of commerce in this clause would seem to make better sense of the framers' in general goals of enabling Congress to regulate all interactions with foreign nations and Indian tribes. Interactions that, if improperly handled by a single state acting on its own, might lead to needless wars and compromise the interest of sister states. So we can see that with the failures of the colonies in the Confederate area, this led directly to the idea that Congress would exercise control over Indian affairs. And if you recall, 11 of the 13 states voted to ratify the Constitution. They agreed that abdicating their sovereignty over Indian affairs was good and necessary for our nation to succeed. So the intrusion or erosion of state sovereignty was settled at the time the Constitution was ratified. And we have harmed ourselves as a state by fighting against this idea for many years since statehood. So packed into this bill are three sentences, some big ideas that were all highlighted in the sponsor statement. But very briefly, Madam Chair, the supporting materials are President Nixon's special address on Indian affairs, the Alaska Supreme Court case, Baker versus John, where our Alaska Supreme Court said that we must recognize Indian tribes in Alaska the same way Congress and the federal government and the U.S. Supreme Court has. Attorney General Lindemuth's letter to Governor Walker on the legal status of tribes in Alaska. And our presenters will also bring other resources that describe self-determination. Nixon's address in the sponsor statement, we refer to this as the era when Alaska obtained statehood, this was during the termination era of federal Indian policy. So we were looking, the nation was struggling with that trust relationship with tribes and walking away from the treaties it had long established. But now we have kind of moved into the area of self-determination under President Nixon. His address was widely recognized as the moment in time when the U.S. government moved toward self-determination, moved toward honoring that trust relationship with federal tribes. And his address as the original statement on self-determination is still one of the best, most succinct, poignant, and insightful statements of this policy. The Baker versus John case is the moment, I think, when our state began turning from the idea of terminating that trust relationship to embracing it, to no longer ignoring tribes, but recognizing that they do exist. Attorney General Lindemuth's memo is when the executive branch acknowledged the law as recognized by the Alaska Supreme Court that tribes do exist here in Alaska. And so with these background materials, you may ask, well, why do we need a bill on this? And that's not a hypothetical question. That's one we were actually asked by Alleged Legal when we were drafting this. But Madam Chair, our reason is it's the Supreme Court's role to declare what the law is in the state, but it's the legislature's role to establish and declare the policy of the state. So the purpose of the bill is to declare that the state will no longer, as a matter of policy, ignore the existence of tribes in Alaska. The bill declares the end of the termination era in Alaska, and that thinking is part of our state policy. So it necessarily means, but not explicitly stated within the bill, is that the state is taking a step towards self-determination. And what self-determination might look like on the state level will take a longer and deeper conversation than this bill seeks to address. But the conversation cannot begin until the state stops and is at least willing to acknowledge that tribes are in the room with us and that they have a proper place in this room. Thank you, Madam Chair, and my staff, Ken, has just a few comments on the bill itself.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. This is Ken Truitt, again, staff for Representative Kopp. I'll just briefly explain the committee substitute that came out of the prior committee and then just walk through the substantive provisions of the bill. Representative Kopp mentioned three sentences, and we'll look at those real quickly. In the prior committee, a preamble was added to the bill. That's now in Section 1. So we added uncodified provisions to the uncodified. In the uncodified law, new provisions that contain legislative findings and intent about kind of the indigenous people's history here, being here from time immemorial, and the legislature exercising its policy-making power. if you the really the operative provision of the bill is now in Section 5. The provisions between Section 1 and Section 5 are conforming and technical changes that the drafters in Ledge Legal have put in based on where they will house this new section in the statutes. The first sentence, page 2, starting on lines 27, pretty much just declares that first and foremost that federal recognition is a federal question, as Representative Kopp was requiring or mentioning. You will hear from our presenters who will give an overview of the history of federal Indian law and policy, going back to ratification of the Constitution. This particular sentence uses the words that you would find in President Nixon's address, special and unique. And the intent of including this in the first sentence is to signal to the reader, whether that's the tribes or the courts, that the legislature understands the nature of the relationship that tribes have in this country, that it being recognition being primarily a federal function. The second sentence is really the operative sentence of this section, and it refers to the federally the recognized Tribal List Act, and that is the reference to the United States Code that's in that sentence. So it makes clear that this bill isn't seeking to create a separate state recognition. The whole purpose of the bill is really just to recognize the federal function and the federal recognition that of tribes. The third sentence really is your 10-foot pole that we're not really intending to touch the federal trust relationship, not even with the 10-foot pole. That is important in our opinion because there have been times Representative Kopp mentioned the termination era where the federal government has sought to terminate that trust relationship, and we felt it important to put into this bill an express statement that the legislature is not intending in any way to intrude on the trust relationship that the federal government has with tribes. This bill shouldn't be read to give the federal government an excuse to end that relationship or in any way diminish it. And it also makes clear that it's not the intent of the bill that the state and the legislature is intending to create a separate state trust relationship with tribes. So it's really just a reiteration that this is a federal issue that the state is recognizing. I think since the first hearing on this bill, it's important also to further elaborate on what the bill does not do, what it does and what it does not do. It does not create any additional rights that tribes don't already have right now at this moment in time. So it is essentially just putting into statute and codifying the legal status quo and saying that this is the state policy. I think it's easy sometimes in this building to forget that policy on its own has power, and we think that this is a powerful policy statement that our presenters will also explore as we go through their presentations.
Any questions from the committee before we? And let me just look to a second. My teacher eyes are up. Our next presentation involves a classroom of fifth graders who are out there, and I was trying to figure out whether we were going to shuffle them in. Okay. Too many for the room. We're going to hold. We'll send them to your office. Representative Kreisel.
Thank you. If we're about to transition to the next bill, I guess.
No, question. To the we've got some online presenters on this.
Okay, we're not transitioning to the flag song.
No.
Okay.
Great. Not just yet. I just was. Even if they are silent, moving a body, that many little bodies makes noise. So I was gonna, but they're gonna hold them out there. Representative Klayman.
Just a question that I've. Seeing with a few people asking queries about the bill, specifically with regard to gambling, and certainly federally recognized tribes today, I think have the power to on their land to open up casinos. How does this bill impact that reality in Alaska? There's certainly no tribes that are running casinos today, but how would this impact those powers?
Through the chair, Representative Klayman. So the bill will not change any standing that the tribes have on tribal lands or or anything to do with the state of Indian law or authority that they already have under existing law. So again, the only thing that it would do with it will do nothing with respect to gambling is my very direct answer.
Okay.
Ken, I will defer to you. Is that incorrect?
Through the chair, Ken Truitt, that is correct.
Thank you.
Representative Chris Tompkins, go
ahead. Thank you, Madam Chair. Am I remembering my Alaska history correctly that during the Knowles administration, there was an executive action of some sort called the Millennium Agreement or something similarly titled? And would you be able to speak to the effectively policy juxtaposition between what Governor Knowles did and what the impact of this bill would be if signed into law?
Sure. Through the chair, Ken Truitt, staff for Representative Kopp, Representative Christ Tompkins, our presenters will hit on that precisely. That will be covered in their presentation. But I think the short answer is that this wouldn't necessarily make an executive order or executive action like that unnecessary, but it would really, in our mind, prevent a succeeding administration from withdrawing an order like that. So we're not leaving it up to the executive branch to declare what the policy is. So our hope is that this would create a little more consistency in the relationships that the state could have and form with tribal governments in the state.
Thank you.
Okay. Representative Kopp, do you want me to call on the two presenters we've invited? And I'm not sure. I think we have both Joy Anderson, who's general counsel to the Association of Village Council Presidents, and Natasha Singh, who's the general counsel to Tanana Chiefs online. So please go ahead and put yourselves on the record.
Thank you. So we'll both be doing a joint presentation today. So if you could just allow us to keep our lines unmuted throughout the PowerPoint, that would be wonderful. My name is Natasha Singh. I'm general counsel for Tanana Chiefs Conference. TCC is a tribal consortium representing the 37 federally recognized tribes of interior Alaska.
Morning. My name is Joy Anderson. I'm general counsel for the Association of Village Council Presidents, also a tribal consortium located in Southwest Alaska, representing 56 federally recognized tribes. And next slide, please.
On slide two, you will see a quote from the Alaska Supreme Court. Before the coming of Europeans, the tribes were self-governing, sovereign political communities. So I'd just like to first point out that the existence of a tribe or a tribal government does not require federal determination, and tribal sovereignty does not originate with the federal government. Before the United States and before the state of Alaska, there were tribes. The tribal form of government is something that you and I likely can't comprehend, namely because we are not native language speakers. And the native languages really, really encompassed everything our government was about. Take all your notions of government and economy that you learned in college and throw them out. Tribal governments were based on a rule of law determined by the creator, the land, and the animals. Our tribal governments are religious and spiritually based, and that continues today. tribal leaders created tribal governments in reflection of these laws of the Creator. The present-day tribes have remnants of these traditional governments, despite hundreds of years aimed at extinguishing tribes. Today, our tribes, I have been told by Chief Nancy James of Gwichaje and Fort Yukon, are tasked simply with protecting the land and the children. Next slide, please.
And just before you start on the slides, I need to put on the record that Representative Drummond has joined us at 8:25. But go ahead.
There are 573 federally recognized tribes in the United States. 229, about half of those, are in Alaska. A federally recognized tribe is an American Indian or Alaska Native tribal entity that has a government-to-government relationship with the United States. This relationship is described as a domestic-dependent nation, and we'll talk about that more in the next couple of slides. As Natasha just said, tribes have inherent powers and authorities and the right to self-government. For example, it's a tribe's decision what form of government to have, who is eligible to be a tribal citizen or member, etc. Tribes exercise all of their inherent power unless those powers have been expressly limited by Congress. That means the determining factor is not whether Congress has said a tribe can do something, but whether Congress has expressly said a tribe cannot do something. That's because, as was just said, tribal governments have always existed. Tribes, again, as part of self-government, regulate matters pertaining to tribal members. That includes taxation and property regulation, regulating members' conduct, domestic relations, etc. Tribes are also immune from lawsuits. Tribes are a unique entity. They're not a state or part of the federal government or a nonprofit. A tribe is distinct. Next slide. The next slide will go over again the brief history and the relationship between tribes and the United States government. Thank you, Representative Kopp, for covering this as well. I think it's so important, and I just wish every citizen of the United States received this history, especially in Alaska, where there are over 230 federally recognized tribes. And there's such a large population of Alaska Native tribal members. So on slide 5, you'll see this graph that demonstrates the federal Indian policy period. So this graph really describes the relationship between the tribes and the federal government over time and how the federal government attempted different policies regarding tribes. First, there was the colonial policy, the first contact, where the relationship was just getting going. Then there was the removal, relocation policy. Then there was the reservation treaty making policy that ended right before 1900. Then there was the allotment making policy that lasted for about 40 years. And then there was recognition that these past four policies were so detrimental to the tribes. We entered into what they call the Indian self-government policy, which also didn't quite work because it had great intentions, but the policy aimed for the federal government to dictate to tribes what was best for them, and so it didn't end up working. So then you went to a termination policy from 1950 to the 60s where, you know, the federal government just wanted to just do away with their relationship with tribes. And what happened was, well, tribes still existed despite the fact the federal government tried to end a relationship, and it just ended up hurting the United States and tribes alike. So then we enter into the self-determination period,
really the federal government under President Nixon's leadership, recognizing that the best thing for people is to recognize their self-determination, return the authority back to local control, and see where we can go from there. And that is the period we're now in self-determination, and that kind of summarizes where we are. Next slide, please.
These next couple of slides will talk about the policy and law around Indian tribes that was created in the beginning of those policy periods mentioned on the last slide. At the very beginning of the United States history of the nation, tribes were recognized as being these distinct entities with powers and authority of individual government, even though they were subject to the United States authority. Of course, we all know, as a result of the U.S. government's power over tribes, there was widespread oppression and loss inflicted on the tribes. However, from the beginning, there was always the concept of tribal government. In 1831, a few decades before Alaska became a territory of the United States, and only 55 years after the U.S. came into existence, the United States Supreme Court, under Chief Justice Marshall, determined that Indian tribes are what Justice Marshall called domestic dependent nations. He described these as distinct, independent political communities under the control of the United States. Here's a quote from that case on your slide, on the screen. A weaker power does not surrender its independence, its right to self-government, by associating with a stronger and taking its protection. A weak state, in order to provide for its safety, may place itself under the protection of one more powerful without stripping itself of the right of government and ceasing to be a state. Next slide.
Ms. Anderson, we're getting a really static communication when you speak, and so we're wondering if you could, if you were on a speakerphone, try picking up the handset, or if... that's pretty, let's see, try it again.
Is this better?
Nope, that's not any better. So our second suggestion from the teleconference goddess is that you, if you're, so I take it you're not on a cell phone, but if you could get to a landline or if you just dial in again and they'll see if we get a better connection.
So sure, if we...
Okay, and if you're following that pattern, that means we've got a slide for Ms. Singh to get us through, and then we'll have a clear communication from your next slide.
Okay, hold on one second.
And we are at the slide with slide number 7 with the Marshall Trilogy up.
Okay. This is Joy's slide, actually, but I'll go over the Marshall Trilogy. So the slide I was about to present is fine to go over first, and that's really what is the basis for the federal-tribal relationship, and it's the same basis as what's the relationship with the state-federal relationship, and that's the U.S. Constitution. The U.S. Constitution in Article 1, Section 8, Clause 3, states Congress shall have the power to regulate commerce with foreign nations and among several states and with Indian tribes. So with that commerce clause, Congress has what they call plenary power over the tribes, and they're allowed to, Congress is allowed to make policy either. And they're really the only ones allowed to terminate the relationship with the federal government, Congress is, or terminate any rights we have. The administration does not have the power to terminate our rights. But that's the basis. The Constitution is the basis. And that's where you have developed, that's where Marshall came in. And the Marshall Trilogy that formed the framework of federal Indian law. And this is three cases in about the 1830s, around that time, when they were dealing with tribes on the East Coast, namely the Cherokee Nation. So you'll see on the slide that it goes through Aboriginal land claims. The cases pointed out that Aboriginal people retain the rights and use of occupancy that only the United States government can settle Aboriginal land claims, and that the U.S. has a legal duty to protect Aboriginal title until land claims are officially settled. Tribal authority. Tribes are nations with the authority to govern themselves. The source of their authority to govern is inherent, meaning that it comes from tribes being self-governing long before explorers. And finally, the Marshall Trilogy established the federal trust responsibility. The federal government has a responsibility to protect Indian lands and resources and to provide essential services to Indian people. This comes from the fact that the federal government took away the vast majority of Indian lands and in return promised to provide those things. So the Marshall Trilogy really established the basis for federal Indian law, and that's where the Supreme Court has developed this foundation of what exactly, how to quite exactly implement the Commerce Clause. Is Joy back on the line?
Joy is back on.
Are you able to hear me better?
Much better.
Oh, good. I'm on a cell phone now. Okay, Joy, we're on slide 8, the Alaska Purchase.
Thank you. So in 1867, Russia sold its claims to Alaska to the United States with a treaty. The treaty included the words on this slide, and it's just one of many examples of how colonialism wrongly treated indigenous peoples as inferior. The premise of this part of the treaty was that native peoples were uncivilized, so the colonial government had the power to civilize them with laws. So Russia considered itself as passing power over Alaska Natives and Alaska Native tribes to the United States. And so as a result, tribes were under the United States authority. What's key for our presentation today is the fact that from the very beginning, there was the awareness that tribes existed in Alaska. Next slide.
For slide 9, I've already covered Article 1, Section 8 of the Constitution, but I'd just like to point out that Congress's plenary control over Alaska Natives can be seen with the Alaska Native Claims Settlement Act, where Congress used its plenary power to extinguish Alaska Native rights to hundreds of millions of acres of land, and including our hunting and fishing rights. Next slide, to slide 10. So going back to the eras of federal Indian policy, I left with saying we are now in the self-determination era of policy. This is the only policy that has worked to make significant progress in reversing otherwise distressed social, cultural, and economic conditions in Native communities. The policy of self-determination reflects a political equilibrium which has held for four decades and which has withstood various shifts in the party control of Congress and the White House. The first major piece of legislation, Public Law 638, the Indian Self-Determination Act of 1975, this act really gave the tribes the authority to identify federal government services that they wished to provide to their own tribal members, contract the federal government, and to provide those services themselves. And so this is the authority that you see the Alaska Tribal Health System based off of, is the Indian Self-Determination Act, whereas the Indian Health Service wasn't providing adequate services because they were dictating what those services would look like from D.C. They gave the local control back to our tribes and were able to implement a very successful healthcare system. And this is really the foundation of self-determination. Just to point out, if we did a policy era in the relationship between tribes and the state government and the state of Alaska, you would see that we were still in an era of termination. Right now, we have the justice, the Alaska courts recognizing tribes, and we have administrations that sometimes recognize tribes and sometimes try to deny tribes' existence and rights. And so we would like this bill to take us out of that termination era that the United States was in the 1800s and move us into a self-determination era, the only successful policy that has worked with tribes. Next slide, please.
An example of this move into the self-determination era is one of the United States recognizing its government-to-government relationship with tribes through tribal consultation. Consultation and coordination with Indian tribal governments, Executive Order 13175, was issued by President Bill Clinton on November 6, 2000. And 9 years later, on November 5, 2009, President Barack Obama issued a presidential memorandum directing each agency to submit a detailed plan of action of how the agency will implement the policies and directives of that executive order. And some of the highlights of that order are on these two slides that I'll go over now. So it established regular and meaningful consultation and collaboration with tribes in the development of federal policies that have tribal implications. Recognizes that the United States has a unique legal relationship with Indian tribal governments as set forth in the U.S. Constitution, treaties, statutes, executive orders, and U.S. Supreme Court decisions. Confirms that the U.S. recognizes Indian tribes as domestic dependent nations under its protection. Next slide, slide 12.
Ladies, now that we got rid of the static, we can't tell which one of you is presenting, and for the record, if you could identify when you switch back and forth so that we can keep track of who's presenting, that would be helpful.
Yes. Sorry, this is Joy Anderson, and I just did slide 11, and I'm continuing on to slide 12.
Thank you.
The executive order also recognizes a trust relationship with Indian tribes, recognizes the right of Indian tribes to self-government, tribal authority, and self-determination, and mandates that all federal agencies are to respect Indian tribal self-government and authority. Next slide.
This is Natasha. So I touched on, you know, where we are in the brief history of the relationship between the state of Alaska and tribes. On slide 14, it goes over the Alaska position that tribes, you know, did not exist. Tribes have been battling this in litigation and still really, really are. I think my colleague, Holly Handler, will go have a more thorough presentation on the litigation that tribes continually win because the U.S. Constitution is just the plenary authority in this country. And federal Indian law is just so clear. It's really a battle the state has chosen to take, ignoring the law. And in fact, it's been very detrimental, the litigation, and because often the litigation is around the tribe's ability and authority to protect their own children. When tribes are seeking to take action to protect their own children, the state has denied that authority, and that has been very detrimental. That's the era we're kind of currently in. We see with some actions with the administration and now with some opportunities to educate the legislature and lawmakers on Alaska Native tribes, we see kind of an out from this era, but the bill would really be removing us from the termination era we find ourselves with in the state tribal relationship. Next slide, please. This is Joy for slide 15 and 16. So slide 15. In response to the arguments of the Native Village of Stevens, the U.S. Department of the Interior did two things. First, issued a solicitor's opinion known as the Sansonetti opinion in 1993, and that opinion disagreed with the Alaska Supreme Court's historical analysis in Stevens Village. It observed that for over 50 years, Congress and the Department of Interior treated Alaska Natives as members of tribes and concluded there were federally recognized tribes in Alaska. Then 9 months later, DOI issued a list of federally recognized tribes in Alaska. Congress then confirmed the department when it directed BIA to publish the list of recognized tribes. And that was done in 1994, referred to as the 1994 List Act. And Congress even overrode the admission of one Alaska tribe from that original list. This list is published annually, and all subsequent lists of the List Act since 1994 have continued to include Alaska tribes. Next slide, slide 16. Initially, the state of Alaska challenged this response, but then in 1996 discontinued litigation. The state attorney general also issued an opinion that outlined the status of federally recognized tribes. However, that opinion contained some inaccuracies, such as that state courts could not transfer jurisdiction of child protection cases to tribal courts. Then in 1999, the Alaska Supreme Court and John B. Baker clearly recognized that there were tribes in Alaska. There's a quote from that case on the screen. If Congress or the executive branch recognizes a group of Native Americans as a sovereign tribe, we must do the same. In 2018, Governor Walker did the same thing. There had been a previous administration order recognizing tribes, but it had been overturned. So in 2018, there's a quote from that administration order on the screen as well. It states, we will improve government-to-government relations with Alaska tribes. And also, I believe, included in your materials is a copy of the Department of Law opinion in 2017 that has a thorough analysis as well. Next slide. And this is Joy speaking. House Bill 221 will bring the Alaska State Legislature in line with the other two branches of state government. As we've just seen, the court has recognized the status of Alaska tribes, the Alaska Supreme Court, and also the Alaska Executive Branch. House Bill 221 will also modernize the policy towards Alaska Native tribes by officially moving the state legislature out of the termination era and into the self-determination era.
Finally, the bill, it just creates the foundation for the potential for the state of Alaska to lead this country in creation of a state-tribal relations. We have such strong tribes in the state of Alaska, and we have such a strong state. There's so much we can do in partnership, and through this official recognition through the state legislature, you know, you're just opening the door for such a great potential that we will establish the relationship together. I heard a question earlier about gaming. Federal tribal gaming, in order for that to be successful, the federal law requires the state to pass state law to allow tribes to game, and it has to really be an agreement between the state of Alaska and tribes.
That's just one example of what has been done. The state of Alaska is different. We're unique. We can do whatever we want with our tribes. And I just feel like this bill is going to, once we're taken out of termination era and onto self-determination, we're going to show the rest of the country really what can be done when the state and tribes work together. And we're going to really elevate tribal communities, and some of them in poverty. We can do something about that. We can elevate our justice system. You've heard so much in the news about the struggles with public safety. There's just so much we can do towards education, and that's going to be determined in the future. But this bill will get us there, at least to have that conversation. So thank you very much for your time. That's the end of our presentation today. Thank you.
Thank you for your very well presented presentation. And I'm looking around the committee table. Representative Christ Tompkins.
Thank you very much, Madam Chair, and appreciate the presentation, Natasha and Joy. I had a couple of questions, sort of contextual knowledge around some of what was presented. The first is, it was stated on the last slide or second to last slide that with passage of this bill, Alaska may well be the leader in state-tribal relations, and I was curious if you could unpack that statement and also share with us, given that this bill is not yet law, which state in the union, in your both's estimation, is the national leader in state-tribal relations, and for what reason? Sort of what laws are on the books that make it so?
So I don't have that information on
Who's speaking, please?
Sorry, this is Natasha. I don't have that information on my fingertips in terms of which states have passed state recognition bills. I know that there are a number of tribes that aren't federally recognized, but that their state legislatures have recognized them. I know there's certain tribes. Unfortunately, the reason we have such a detrimental relationship in the state of Alaska is this long history of litigation between the administration and our tribes. And so where you have states that don't have that long history of litigation, you actually see partnerships. You see partnerships with fishing. You see partnerships in public safety. We just examined a partnership with this state of Washington in tribes and how they're improving their form of state troopers and policing in Native populations. But I'd have to get you that information on which state is the leader. And my comment there is, with this bill, we're not going to be the leaders, but we actually have the potential to get there with the recognition.
This is Joy. If I could add to what Natasha just said, the state of Alaska has the most federally recognized tribes in the United States of any one state. We have 229. So by default, if the state of Alaska and tribes form a close working partnership, if we build on things that have already been in place, like the Tribal Child Welfare Compact, by default, because of the number of tribes, our state can become the leader. Like Natasha said, the potential is definitely there.
Follow up?
Thank you. That's really helpful, and it's more sort of general curiosity, and I really appreciate this legislation and Representative Kopp bringing it forward. And part of the subtext of that question is whether there's other sort of model or best practice law on a state level that can further improve a state's relationships with its tribal government partners. A follow-up question, if I may.
Go ahead.
And this is another sort of contextual knowledge question. In discussing the List Act, I was curious, since that law was enacted by Congress in 94 or whenever it was enacted, I was interested whether the number of federally recognized tribes in Alaska has changed much. So with the annual updates, what fluctuation or augmentation has occurred? And as sort of a second question to that question, I was interested which tribe in Alaska was the tribe that was omitted by DOA that was sort of congressionally overridden and established as a federally recognized tribe in the List Act.
This is Joy Anderson. As you just recalled for us, the List Act, it's been published every year since 1994, published annually. I don't know how the number has changed, but certainly something that's probably available. Can do some research and give that to Ken Truitt if that would be helpful. And same thing with the one tribe that was omitted. I can get that reference for you.
I can speak to that, Madam Chair.
Mr. Truitt has an answer for us.
Right. Through the chair, Representative Christ Tompkins, Ken Truitt. And the tribe that was left off of the list was the Central Council of Tlingit and Haida Indian Tribes. So we won't have to go into why that was left off, but let's just say good relations matter, no matter who you have relationships with. But by a special act of Congress, it was overridden. And to my knowledge, there hasn't been any additions to the 229 from, well, the 228. And then after Congress again recognized the Central Council, the list has been at 229.
Thank you. That's very helpful.
Thank you. Any other questions or comments from committee members? Seeing none, I'm going to thank Mr. Truitt, Representative Kopp, Ms. Singh, and Ms. Anderson for your presentation this morning. It is my intention that we will.
We had Ms. Handler to present as well on state litigation.
Okay. I did not have her on here, but I saw her in the room, so, and she was referenced. All right. Ms. Handler.
Thank you very much. Good morning. Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee. We could spend a whole week talking about tribal litigation in Alaska.
Put your full name on the record.
Oh, I'm sorry. Okay. I'm Holly Handler. I live in Juneau, Alaska. I've worked for Alaska Legal Services as a staff attorney for 14 years. And my current position in the past year has been doing full-time Indian Child Welfare Act work at Tlingit and Haida. So I will try to be respectful of your time and try to cover tribal litigation in Alaska in under 10 minutes. And in your packet, you should have a timeline that looks like this. And what the timeline attempts to do is to provide a visual representation of the 150 years or so since the Alaska Purchase, and to look at the high points and low points of tribal litigation, and to see that in the context of the past 150 years, the anti-tribal litigation in our state has been an anomaly, and recognition of tribes in Alaska has been the norm.
Could you pause for a second and show us the timeline again? We don't have it. Okay. All right.
Looks like this.
We don't have it.
Okay. All right. So we can stop looking. We'll pay attention to the presenter.
Explain it to us.
Yeah. We'll let you.
So to build on the presentation from Joy and Natasha, over the past 150 years, when we talk about the recognition of tribes in Alaska and the consistency of tribal recognition, it is not to gloss over the very painful history of discrimination and violence against indigenous peoples in Alaska. What's remarkable about the past 150 years of Alaska history is that despite ongoing attempts to assimilate indigenous populations, to terminate tribal identity, and to resist the recognition of Indian people as Indian people in our state, there has been a consistent recognition that tribes are here and tribes do exist. And that's been recognized as a matter of federal law, as territorial law, and then since statehood in the state. And so I'll go through that history very briefly, just to put this history of tribal litigation in context. So as much as we like to say that we are all Alaskans, we're all the same, our history shows that there are differences in the histories of the people of Alaska. And the fact that we have different histories isn't good or bad, it is just a fact. And one thing this bill does is help us come to terms with this fact so that we can move forward as a state. We can build, and as Representative Christ-Tompkins mentioned, you know, what is the practical impact of this bill? Well, one of it is that in other states where tribes have been formally recognized in the state, those state governments have been able to build state tribal commissions, state tribal working groups. The judiciaries in various states like Minnesota and Michigan have state tribal working groups so that state courts and tribal courts can work together to pool resources for training, hearing cases together, developing court rules, developing court procedures. In Maine, for example, tribes and the state work together for a Truth and Reconciliation Commission to deal with a very ugly history of removal of Native children in that state. So in looking at this history, the past 150 years of recognition, and start with the purchase. And the purchase itself, the Treaty of Cession, refers to Alaska tribes in a manner that's similar to the way that we refer to lower 48 tribes. The Treaty of Cession does not distinguish in any way between tribes in Alaska and the tribes in lower 48. And they're treated in the same way, which is treating them as self-governing political groups with inherent sovereignty to decide their own affairs. So what this means is that just like here, we're citizens of Alaska and we're citizens of the United States government, indigenous people here are triple citizens. They're citizens of their tribal government, their state government, and the federal government. In the early 1900s, the federal government passed laws for federal reserves, native allotments, and native town sites. And what's notable about that legislation is that they all treat tribes in Alaska as tribes. Those federal acts would not have been possible without the recognition of Alaska tribes as sovereign tribal government. In the 1930s, we had federal recognition of tribal marriage laws, which recognized that tribal governments in Alaska had the authority to establish their own rules and procedures regarding marriage of tribal citizens. In the 1930s, there was a Federal Indian Reorganization Act, the IRA, and we had Alaska's own IRA, in which the federal government recognized that tribes in Alaska have the same ability as tribes in Lower 48 to establish tribal constitutions, work through policies of self-determination and economic development, and again, be treated as sovereign governments. In the 1950s, the federal government passed Public Law 280, which is often cited by anti-tribal advocates as a reason to think that tribes ceased to exist in Alaska. But what Public Law 280 did was extend state jurisdiction over Indian country in Alaska. And you can't have Indian country unless you have sovereign tribes. And so what Public Law 280 did is yet reaffirm once again that we do have sovereign tribes in the state of Alaska. In the 1970s, after statehood, there's major pieces of landmark federal legislation, like Joy and Natasha mentioned, in the new self-determination era. We had the Indian Child Welfare Act, we had Indian Financing Act, we had Federal Education Act that all sought to promote self-determination of tribes and economic development of tribes. And all those acts specifically refer to Alaska Native tribal governments. All these acts from the early 1900s through the 1970s all specifically recognize Alaska village governments and other Alaska tribal governments. So the main point, if you've been sleeping, is that despite the overt racism and institutionalized discrimination in this period, in which we had boarding schools, we had removals of children from families by our government, We had state-sanctioned discrimination in public institutions. One constant in this time has been the recognition of tribal governments here. In 1971, there was the passage of ANCSA. And ANCSA, again, addressed Alaska governments. It established corporate entities in Alaska alongside tribal governments. So it didn't do anything to extinguish government here. It just set up corporate structures to exist alongside. So, like, this is something you probably have to deal with your constituents often, explaining the difference between being a shareholder in a Native corporation, like Sea Alaska, and being a citizen of a tribal government. But in the 1970s, after the passage of ANCSA, anti-tribal advocates seized the opportunity to try to manipulate ANCSA and misinterpret it as a way to believe that tribes had been extinguished here. So in 1986, there was the Nanana case. And the background of that case was there was a village council that asked the state court to transfer a child protection proceeding from state court to tribal court. And as Natasha Singh mentioned, so many of these cases are about Native villages, Native communities trying to protect their own tribal children from abuse and neglect and harm. And that's exactly what the Nanana case was about, was a tribal government working to hear a case about a child in their own tribal court. And for all of you familiar with geography, you know, Nanana doesn't have access to the state court system in the way that our urban communities do. There are not state courts in the majority of Alaska communities. And in the Nanana case, anti-tribal advocates litigated against the tribes to say that Alaska tribes are different, and because they are without land in large part, they've lost their governing authority over their citizens. And for a period from the late 80s to the early 90s, the state court system agreed that there was something in ANCSA that implicitly terminated the existence of tribal governments in Alaska. The Stevens Village case, a contracts case about sovereign immunity, affirmed that attitude. As Joy and Natasha mentioned, we then have the List Act and the Federal Department of Interior recognizing specifically the continued existence of tribes in Alaska. And following up on that List Act was the John B. Baker case, which again was about children and families and the ability of tribal courts to protect children, tribal citizen children. The John V. Baker case specifically was about a disgruntled dad who went to tribal court, lost custody of his child, didn't like the result, so then tried to relitigate the whole case in state court, manipulating the systems and arguably misusing state resources. And in the 1999 John V. Baker decision, the Alaska Supreme Court reviewed the history, these past 150 years of the existence of tribes in Alaska, and looked at the List Act and issued a decision reversing the Nanana and Stevens Village cases and said that no, ANCSA's experiment of resolving land claims through economic development did nothing to distinguish tribal government in Alaska. Tribes still exist here, and tribes still are able and have the authority to protect their own children and families. In the John V. Baker case, notably, the state of Alaska actually issued an amicus brief in support of the tribes. It was a period when the administration was in a position favorable to tribes. The Department of Justice also issued an amicus brief in support of the tribes. And like we mentioned before, there was the Millennium Agreement that followed up on that. And one of the things the Millennium Agreement did was really try to delve into the practicalities of how we have government-to-government relations in Alaska. On the heels of the Millennium Agreement, we had an issuance of new policies and procedures in our State Office of Children's Services for how the state government can work with tribal governments to coordinate protective services for children in our state. And we certainly don't have an abundance of resources for protecting abused and neglected children in our state. And this opportunity in the heels of the Millennium Agreement to work together provided an opportunity to pool resources and work cooperatively. So at this point, when the Millennium Agreement was passed, we thought, well, maybe this blip of anti-tribal litigation was just brief, we're through it, and we're done. And then in 2004, we had the Renke's opinion, which set all of that work back. It basically tore up the Millennium Agreement. It tore up all the work that the Office of Children's Services did with tribes in their policies and procedures, and took up another wave of litigation in the state against the state's own people. There is the Tanana case, which was another child protection case in which tribal government was seeking to protect abused and neglected children in the community. We had the CalTag case, in which a tribal government sought to approve the adoption of a child in a community where there wasn't access to a state court. There is the Clinkett and Haida child support case, which Alaska Legal Services was a part of, and the Native American Rights Fund issued an amicus brief in about the state recognizing tribal child support orders to ensure that there's family responsibility for families in Alaska. And we had the Simmons v. Parks case, which was about protecting a child from violence in their home. In all these cases, the state engaged in litigation that was very painful and very costly. It was painful because tribal citizens in our state were coming to these meetings about tribal sovereignty and litigation and saying, the state doesn't even recognize that we exist. There is nothing more dehumanizing than not recognizing somebody's identity. It was also costly. The state devoted countless resources of the Department of Law to litigate these cases, sometimes seeking cert in the United States Supreme Court. And in those situations, we're paying outside counsel, and at one point paid an outside attorney in DC a $900 an hour fee to try to litigate against Alaska tribes. And what was the return on this investment? It was a total bust. The state of Alaska lost all these cases. And not only did they lose these cases, but it damaged the state's reputation nationally, it damaged the state's reputation against its own people, and it hurt the state's pocketbook. This was an investment that resulted in nothing positive. And we lost these opportunity costs. In the last committee, we talked about a variety of federal granting opportunities that are available to states and tribes that are cooperating together. There are opportunities to work on education matters, child welfare, transportation, education, law enforcement, and health care. And the state lost out on all these opportunities because it focused its energies on litigating against tribes. So what this bill would do to benefit the state is two things. It would commit the state to following a path of cooperating with tribes instead of litigating against tribes, instead of having this back and forth ping pong game where the state is for tribes and against tribes and for tribes and against tribes. We would just commit that we were just going to take a path of cooperation. We're not going to go and endure this painful and expensive litigation again. And it's also choosing a path to pursue these opportunities to work with tribes, to fill in gaps in the state where we need assistance, and to move forward in creative and exciting ways. So, thank you for your attention, and I can answer questions if you have any.
Committee members? I see no hands, so Ms. Handler, thank you for your work for the Alaska Legal Services, and thank you for your presentation this morning.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
And with that, it is the intention of the committee to have this bill before us again on Tuesday, March 3rd. And if you have amendments, I would like them by noon on Monday. We're going to take a brief at ease as we transition to House Bill 193. So we're going to bring the Community and Regional Affairs Committee back to order. Representative Story, House Bill 193 is before us. Would you like to give us an introduction to your bill, please?
Yes, thank you, Co-Chair Hannon and Co-Chair Drummond and members of the committee for the opportunity to hear House Bill 193. House Bill 193 makes official the second verse of the Alaska state song, Alaska's Flag. The second verse honors and recognizes the first people of Alaska and Alaska's diverse cultures. It recognizes the history of Alaska's flag being designed by young 13-year-old Benny Benson and continues the first verse's theme of celebrating the beauty of the land and hope for Alaska's future. It is fitting that the state of Alaska, which now officially recognizes 20 Alaska Native languages, as well as English, as our co-official languages, may officially add the second verse of the state song, which recognizes Alaska's first people who have been here since time immemorial and recognizes all cultures. Carol Beery Davis, an Alaskan pioneer and poet laureate, is the author of the second verse, inspired by her daughter and a friend, Connie Monroe, who expressed dissatisfaction that the song did not acknowledge Alaska Natives. Beery Davis wrote the verse to recognize that Alaska's history began long before sourdoughs arrived. Since the verse was written in 1986, there have been several legislative attempts to make the second verse official, led by legislators from Juneau, Wasilla, Aniak, and most recently by Senator Betty Davis from Anchorage. With a new wave of support from this generation's children and the continued longtime support of those previously advocating to adopt the second verse, plus others, it is time to act. I urge support to officially add the second verse to the Alaska State Song. If my committee wishes, my staff, Caitlin Ellis, will speak more about the bill.
So some of the details of the bill itself, House Bill 193 wouldn't change the first verse at all, but would just officially add the words of the second verse. The bill does not require both verses to be sung, but rather allows people who want to sing the second verse the ability to do so. For example, our national anthem has four verses. Often people only sing the first verse. We wouldn't be mandating that. The University of Alaska Foundation holds the copyright to the music as well as the words to both the first verse and the second verse. The material was authored and generously donated to the university by Eleanor Dusenbury, who composed the music, the words to the first verse by Marie Drake, and the words to the second verse by Carol Beery Davis. The university holds these historic materials in the trust for the benefit of the university and the public. They have a neutral position on the bill. This week here in Juneau, there was a local event in town where a high school choir was asked to sing the flag song. The choir director asked the event organizer if they could sing the second verse. The event organizer spoke to some state officials who advised him not to sing the second verse since it was not yet official. The passage of this bill, House Bill 193, would allow groups to sing the second verse at events like at the beginning of House and Senate sessions, would allow, if desired, the verse to be printed in addition to the first verse in places where it's currently printed, such as in our pocket legislative directory, the Capitol Building Guide, the printed programs for public events, and on the Alaska.gov website. Officially adopting the second verse tells a more complete story, a full picture of Alaska, and honors all the cultures here. We're happy to take questions now or after our more knowledgeable and spirited other testifiers, whatever you'd prefer.
Do we have any questions from? I believe we should go on to the next special invited presenters. And I did want to give any parents or principal or teachers who wanted to, if you wanted to step up here to take pictures back, please feel free to do so. But I believe we have Will Faith Contreras, Hunter Cart, Sahara Shoemaker, and Judah Marr, who are scheduled to be our next testifiers. And what you need to do is you need to tell us your full name, and then you can tell us what you'd like us to know.
Thank you, co-chairs Drummond and Hannon. Hi, my name is Hunter Cart, and I am a fifth grader at Glacier Valley Elementary School. I want to start by thanking Representative Andy Story for all of her support. What HB 193 means to me is to be respectful to elders and be more kind and inclusive to all Alaskan Native cultures and all cultures, just like the second verse. Also, by passing this bill, it would show that if kids put their minds to something and work hard, anything is possible. Thank you all for your time, and I encourage you to vote yes for HB
193. My name is Faith Contreras, and my Tlingit name is Dastia. In the first verse, they talk about the gold of the early sourdough's dreams and has no mention of the Alaska Natives who was on this land for thousands of years before. I feel proud to be Alaska Native, but I feel even more proud to be included in the second verse. Gunishchish hawa doiksit news.
Gunishchish. Any questions from the committee? Then we'll bring Sahara and Judah up. And again, if you will say your full name, and that puts you officially on the record.
Hello, my name is Sahara Shoemake. I am part of the Dippers in Glacier Valley, and I am a supporter of House Bill 193. I want to say thank you to Representative Andy Story for making this possible. The reason why I think the Alaska flag song second verse should be official is because it is important for not just children to know who Benny Benson was and who he is today. I was talking to my mom last night about doing this, and when I mentioned Benny Benson, she didn't know who he was, and she's heard the first verse before. Also, it might just spark an idea that if you work hard at your dreams, no matter how hard it gets, to keep trying like Benny Benson did. My second reason is the Alaska, second Alaska flag song verse says to share life's treasures hand in hand to keep Alaska our great land. Not just honoring the settlers and or the Alaska Natives, it's honoring everyone. It's like a little welcome from Alaska for people who come. It's like, hey, we'll honor you, we'll support you, we'll respect you. My third reason is that the Alaska Natives are often forgotten, and the first verse doesn't say anything about the Alaska Natives, and Benny Benson was an Alaska Native. So I think the Alaska Natives should have more of a voice in the second verse. Thank you for your time, and thank you for everyone for listening. I persuade you to vote yes to House Bill 193. Thank you.
I would like to thank co-chairs Drummond and Hannon and the House Community and Regional Affairs Committee for inviting the Dippers to testify today. I would also like to recognize the Aquan people whose land we are standing on today. Judah Dawayu, Sim Shanyu, Lashif Diptegu. My name is Judah Marr. I am Sim Shan from the Eagle Clan. I am 9 years old. I am in Ms. Hopkins' fourth grade class at Glacier Valley Elementary. I'm a Dipper. I would like to thank Representative Story for sponsoring HB 193. I would also like to give a special thank you to our music teacher, Ms. Heggie, for all of her help with the Dippers. I strongly believe that the second verse of the Alaska flag song should be made official because the first line, which reads, "A Native lad chose the Dipper stars for Alaska's flag," recognizes Benny Benson, who drew the design for the Alaska flag. The second verse also recognizes the Alaska Native people who were the first people of this land. I encourage you to all vote yes on HB 193. I would like to offer for my friends to stand up and sing, join me in singing the second verse and first verse of the Alaska flag song.
Thank you. And if the committee, Ms. Hagee.
Just the gentlemen that are squished, could you come up a little bit? Yeah, spread out. Thank you.
Thank you so much for that performance, Representative Thompson.
I just wanted to tell all of you young people that I had the very fine privilege of knowing Benny Benson, and in 1972, we had a state Elks convention in Fairbanks. And at that meeting, I had the honor of introducing Benny Benson and Dave Adler. Now, Dave Adler, 50 years before, was on the committee that picked which flag was going to be our Alaska flag, and they had never ever met 50 years later, and I got to introduce them at the State Elks Convention in Fairbanks, and then I became a friend of Benny's. He was a Elk member from Kodiak, and he was a very, very gracious, wonderful man. So I just wanted to share that with you.
Representative Drummond.
Thank you. I'm so grateful for all of you students coming forward and doing this. The last time a bunch of Alaska students put their mind to it, they helped name the Alaska state dog, the Malamute. And that happened in about 2010 under the guidance of my former state senator, Berta Gardner, who was a representative at the time. And my house district in Anchorage includes the whole of Benson Boulevard, named after Benny Benson, and there's a beautiful memorial to the flag itself, a really cool sculpture on the corner of Minnesota Drive and Benson Boulevard. I should get a picture of it and bring it in to show you where he is honored. I'm sure he is honored in other places in the state, but you got me thinking about it this morning, and I really appreciate it. So keep at it, and we should be able to add this this verse to the flag song, and it's totally appropriate that a bunch of school kids are going to help us do this. Thank you so much.
We do have one more invited guest to testify. We have two? Okay. And I do the students all know who Ms. Monroe is? And for any, so Ms. Monroe, Connie Monroe, she happens to be the daughter, the little girl who the lyrics were written for. Thank you very much for inviting me. And I certainly thank you all for your wonderful leadership. I have never, ever heard young adults testify in front of any legislative committee. So that is a great gift for me. I'm a 50-year Alaska citizen, and I came in 1971, and the first thing that I found when I heard the song was that the people addressed in the song were the outsiders, the sourdoughs seeking gold. Interestingly enough, my daughter works for Donlin Gold in Anchorage and has just hired 100 Alaska Natives to open up a gold mine. My education is a GED graduate, and I went on to Anchorage at Alaska Methodist University, where I got my bachelor's and master's degree. Ironically, I became the state director for GEDs and also federal and state programs K through 12. So I was able to travel in about two-thirds of every village in the state, speaking with superintendents and going through their programs. And it was interesting to me that all of them used the second verse in their graduation and for special activities too. So that was a wonderful start to try and get the state to recognize it. Betty Davis was one, Senator Davis, I'm sure all of you know. And we've even sang it in a group. The state Alaska Native Sisterhood and Brotherhood had a resolution, and of which I am also a member. But one of the interesting things is the reason that Carol Berry Davis wrote this song is I lost my job with the state during our downfall in the early 80s, and it was my farewell gift as I was prepared to move to Boston to work for the Department of Ed there, which, by the way, it never happened because 6 weeks later, we all got hired back. And the song just moved me. I refused to sing it until the indigenous people were recognized. And that's how this all came about. So I'm here to testify again. It was, the House and Senate has passed it many times, and it died in committee. There was one person who thought that the second verse was not to his liking. I pleaded with him then to find someone to write another one, which we never have. And our legislators at that time said that we will not hold a contest because it'll open up a can of worms. Instead, we'll wait for someone to write it and present it to us. And so that's how that happened. And that's why Carol wrote it. And she was an incredible, absolutely incredible song person. She's a poet laureate for the state of Alaska. And I do hope that you commit yourselves to
pass it through the House. You are our leaders. We look forward to you for your guidance and your support. And I know that the House will consider it at least on their agenda. And I thank you very much. And I thank these wonderful students who came here to support this.
Any questions for Ms. Monroe?
Just one question.
Okay. Ms. Monroe, we have a question for you.
Oh, do you have a
question? Yes.
Okay.
Please. Representative Klayman.
Sometimes I lose track of all the, what's your relationship to the woman who wrote this the second verse?
Yes. Pardon?
What's your relationship to the woman who wrote the second verse?
Her daughter was my best friend.
Okay.
I met her when I first came to Juneau, and was absolutely amazed at her ability to teach music and write music and compose music. She also is the publisher of about 8 books that she wrote when she was here. She came during the Gold Rush, played the piano for the silent films. She was just an incredible person. And also the totem, the book titled The Totem Songs, are the first book ever published of Alaska Native music. And the State Library has several copies if you ever want to get it.
Thank you.
Anyone else?
I'm very nervous, by the way. I'm 85, so I'm really an elder now, and retired in Juneau, and very grateful for state retirement and health care. And I've just learned that I'm cancer-free. So I want to thank all the Alaskan doctors for saving me for this day.
All right, we have one more invited testimony. Ms. Fuller, if you will please join us and put your name on the record.
My name is Ann Fuller. That's Ann C. Fuller, named for my great aunt, her mother, and her grandmother. I reside in the city and borough of Juneau. I'm here today representing myself, and I'm speaking in favor of making a second verse official. I'm a storyteller, and when I listen or tell stories over, I find I ponder the words. Natsatlani, you must look towards the place you want to go to. Or Ipanamandas, you don't have the sense you were born with. And the Bible story that made the most sense to me, growing up by the ocean, the house built on sand was washed away. So words matter. The printing and singing of this second verse will touch our minds. I think people will ponder no bars among our cultures. So I remember the words of Elizabeth Paradovich that have come down to us at Advice. Speak your intent to help us overcome discrimination. Please move this bill along. Thanks.
Hold on for a second. Let me just see if there's anyone on the committee who had any questions. All right,
certainly. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Fuller. Is there anyone else who would like to testify who hasn't had the chance? Ms. Hagee, please join us.
Hi, my name is Lori Hagee, and I'm the music teacher at Glacier Valley Elementary School. I want to thank co-chairs Drummond and Hannon for having us and for the committee to consider this important House Bill 193. it was students at this school who really have driven this and met with Representative Story, who I want to thank for listening to their reasons and for putting this bill forward. Many students who wanted to testify couldn't today, but there's one that really sticks with me. Yesterday we presented at the Innovation Summit for 10 minutes to show the process of when people come together and have a reason to work creatively to make a difference and a change in our community and our state, that you can if you work together. At the very end of their presentation, Ave Tuavaifole said, "We stand here, very different backgrounds," and they listed them off: Guam, Tlingit, Filipino, Samoan. Am I missing any others? Just up on those eight. German, thank you. And they said, Korean, that we are all Alaskan, and that this second verse includes, inclusive of this incredible diversity in our state and of the children that we hope will be leading in our future, and that they feel included in this process. So I want to thank you for considering this in such a meaningful way, and for listening to their voices and understanding what this second verse means to them. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Higgy. Anyone else? Thank you. For the edification of the kids in the room, it is our practice to have a bill before us twice. So today was the first time, and we will hold it till Tuesday when we next meet as a committee. We'll let anyone else who wants to speak at that time speak before we take an action on the bill. So I am sure your classroom teachers can give you a refresher on the process or make you watch Schoolhouse Rocks. But it is our practice to have two committee hearings before we move a bill out. So even though we're not going to vote to move it out today, that does not mean it's not going to move out. It's a slow process. Representative Story, did you have any concluding remarks for us?
Thank you, Co-Chair Hannon. I was approached, got a phone call from Dr. Lori Hagee, the music teacher who just testified this fall, telling me that her students in singing this song really felt it was important to have it officially become the second verse. And because of my history in Alaska, I could remember past times when the Alaska Native Sisterhood sang up here at the Capitol building on it, and I knew there was a deep longing to have the second verse become part of our state song. So obviously when these students came to tell me their reasons in my office, it was very compelling, and I could see their sincerity and their value and what these words do mean to them. So it was easy for me hearing their plea and knowing that there have been many people in the past who wish this to happen. I did want to say that I also knew Carol Berry Davis. When I first came to Alaska, I had my bachelor's and master's in social work. I was a home health aide, and I was her home health aide. And I had the privilege of being in her home, helping her with some very personal daily tasks, and her husband, Trevor Davis. So that also touched me. In fact, when I got married, Carol could not come back to Minnesota, and we had made my wedding dress, and I lugged it up the stairs in her home, tried it on for her, and I have some wonderful pictures of her and I together. So this moves me in many different ways, but most of all, it moves me because it honors all the cultures here in Alaska, recognizes the first people here, and I urge your passage of this bill.
Thank you. Any questions or comments from the committee? Well then, like I said, my intention as the chair is that we're going to put this aside till Tuesday, and that we'll be back here on Tuesday, March 3rd at 8 a.m., and House Bill 193 will be before us again. And if there is nothing else to come before the committee, we are adjourned at 9:50. Now we can ask. Thank you. Representative Christ Tompkins.
Maybe that should be the third verse. If you
thank you for
humoring
thank you, Dr. Weiss. Thank you, Dr. Hagee. Thank you. Are we at Dr. Parler yet? Okay. Thank you, Principal Potter, and for all the parents who took time off work to shuttle extra, to arrange extra logistics today, and get out special clothes to wear. You gentlemen look so handsome, all dressed up with ties and shirts. Yes, you're looking good, as all rap stars should. But we will adjourn today at 9:54.